From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
They attack on me because I wear the turban.
Today, we'll look at an attack on a family of six in Queens, New York. The police are calling it a bias crime. Then we go to St. Louis to be with an Egyptian family, an Egyptian-American family, as their father is in the midst of deportation. A report by the Environmental Protection Agency's Inspector General says the White House pressured the EPA not to warn New York residents about the potential health effects following the collapse of the World Trade Center. And we go to Monrovia to hear from Christian Science Monitor's Nicola Tano on Liberia after the departure of President Charles Taylor. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Charles Taylor stepped down as president of Liberia yesterday, surrendering power to his vice president, Moses Blah. He then flew into exile in Nigeria. The Associated Press described hundreds of Liberians lining the country's rock-lined shores, exclaiming and hugging on a day they prayed would mark a turning point for Liberia. We'll have a live report from Monrovia in a few minutes. Four people, including two suicide bombers, died in back-to-back attacks in Israel and the West Bank today. The first attack occurred at a shopping center in the Israeli town of Rosh Ha'in. The second took place 40 minutes later at a bus stop near the Israeli settlement town of Ariel in the West Bank. Agence France-Presse reports the attacks come 4 days after an Israeli raid on the West Bank town of Nablus that left four Palestinians and an Israeli soldier dead. No group has taken responsibility for the bombings. A Hamas spokesperson told AFP Israel is, quote, responsible for the situation because of their rejection of the ceasefire and their tough position. The attacks were the first suicide bombings in the area since July 7th. President Bush yesterday nominated Utah Governor Michael Leavitt to head the Environmental Protection Agency, replacing Christy Todd Whitman, who resigned in May. Philip Clapp, head of the National Environmental Trust, said, quote, I can't think of too many governors more hostile to government regulations than Mike Leavitt. We'll have more on this later in the program. Bush's announcement came at the beginning of a 3-week drive during which he hopes to bolster his environmental image. A Wilderness Society official in Montana predicted Bush would attempt to, quote, do more environmental stuff in the next 3 weeks than he's done in the last 3 years. In news from the California gubernatorial recall, the San Francisco Chronicle is reporting it's obtained documents that reveal, quote, a Republican strategy to oust Governor Gray Davis and help President Bush before the 2004 presidential election. And yesterday, California Secretary of State Kevin Shelley warned the cost of the recall to taxpayers will be about $66 million. He also said it may take 5 weeks after the October 7th recall for state officials to certify a winner in the race. He told reporters, quote, let me be candid, there are going to be problems. The Associated Press is reporting private analysts now estimate the total cost of the invasion and reconstruction of Iraq will be $600 billion. The estimate's far higher than anything put forward by the Pentagon, which estimates it is spending $3.9 billion a month, but that does not include the cost of replacing damaged equipment or the cost of munitions used in the invasion. The British government yesterday opened an inquiry into the death of weapons scientist David Kelly, who allegedly killed himself after being identified as the British official who told the BBC the Blair administration had exaggerated the case for war. Yesterday, evidence emerged that many top officials within British intelligence shared Kelly's belief that Blair was distorting the evidence to make his case for invasion. In addition, The Guardian reports Kelly played a much more significant role in advising British officials on the controversial Iraq dossier than had been previously disclosed. In Iraq, six huge explosions rocked a U.S. military base west of Baghdad late last night. There was no report on U.S. casualties. The attack came hours after 2,000 U.S. troops raided two nearby villages in the hunt for backers of Saddam Hussein. The Guardian of London is reporting U.S. troops killed six Iraqi civilians, including a father and three of his children, over the weekend in Baghdad. The family members were shot dead as they were hurrying home before the nightly curfew. Surviving family members say the U.S. troops gave them no warning. 36-year-old Anwar Khawaz said, quote, "We kept shouting, 'We're a family, don't shoot.' But no one listened. They kept shooting. She lost her husband and three of her four children." Americans who traveled to Iraq to act as human shields before the invasion are now facing $10,000 in fines or 10 years in jail. The Treasury Department is charging the protesters violated U.S. sanctions by going to Iraq. In Afghanistan, two Pakistani border guards have died after being mistakenly shot and bombed by U.S. Special Ops forces. The ongoing heat wave in Europe has threatened the safety of nuclear plants in France, which rely on river to cool the reactor casings. In campaign news, Delaware Senator Joseph Biden announced Monday he will not seek the Democratic presidential nomination. And the Fox News Channel is suing liberal humorist Al Franken and his publisher, The Penguin Group, in an attempt to block the publication of his new book entitled Lies and the Lying Liars Who Tell Them, A Fair and Balanced Look at the Right. The book's cover features photos of four of the so-called lying liars that Franken writes about. Fox host Bill O'Reilly, commentator Ann Coulter, and President George Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney. Among other things, Fox claims the term fair and balanced cannot be used in the title because it was trademarked by the news organization in 1995. Fella here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Charles Taylor stepped down as president of Liberia yesterday, but not before saying, quote, "God willing, I will be back." In his farewell address, he said, quote, "I have accepted this role as the sacrificial lamb. I am the whipping boy." Under pressure from rebels from the Liberians United for Reconciliation and Democracy, known as LURD, Taylor surrendered power to his vice president, Moses Blah, then flew into exile in Nigeria. Blah himself is to hand over power in October to a transitional government meant to lead Liberia into elections. Rebels have seized most of Liberia in their three-year campaign to depose Taylor and have laid siege to the capital, Monrovia. Amid Taylor's departure, three U.S. warships with 2,300 Marines and 2,500 sailors aboard moved within sight of shore. The ships have been within 100 miles of Liberia for more than a week. U.S. officials said they were awaiting the right moment before bringing them into sight. Associated Press described hundreds of Liberians lining the country's rock-lined shores, exclaiming and hugging in a dramatic day they prayed could mark the turning point for their country. President George Bush said Taylor's exile, quote, is an important step, but gave no hint whether it moved him closer toward deploying more U.S. troops to assist with peacekeeping or humanitarian relief efforts. In a CNN interview yesterday, Blah appealed to U.S. Marines offshore. He said, please come to Liberia and save us because we are dying. We are hungry. We go now to Monrovia to Christian Science Monitor reporter Nicole Itano. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us. Can you describe the what happened yesterday when Charles Taylor left, his final speech, and what is happening today in Monrovia? Nicole?
Yes, I'm still here.
If you could just explain what has happened in this transition, if you would call it at this point a transition of power, and what is happening with Liberians now in Monrovia.
Well, yesterday, as you said, there was a ceremony. It was quite a formal ceremony where power was handed over from Mr. Taylor to Mr. Blah. There was quite a few ambassadors and dignitaries from other African countries who came to witness that. Surprisingly, there wasn't a lot of celebration in the streets outside. That is until the American ships appeared off the shore. And then, as you said, there were hundreds of people who came out to witness that. Today, we have heard, however, that there has been some fighting not from the Lurd rebel group who control the port, but from a second rebel group who have controlled the second city of Buchanan. We've heard today that they are moving towards the airport, which is about 25, 30 miles outside of the city, and that people have been displaced in that area and are moving towards Monrovia. But here in Monrovia, it has been fairly quiet today.
Can you talk about what they are demanding and what about the U.S. troops off the coast of Liberia?
Well, until now, we've always heard from both rebel groups, both Modell, which is the one moving towards the airport, and Lurd, the one that controls the port, that they were fighting for the removal of Charles Taylor. So the thing that's concerning right now with this fighting near the airport is that may not truly be enough to satisfy them. They have said in the past that they're not happy with the choice of Moses Blah, who is Taylor's vice president, as the new interim president of Liberia, but so far had seemed to be willing to allow him to hold the presidency for a short time until the negotiations in Accra, Ghana, completed. In terms of American troops, we haven't yet heard what, if any, role they will be playing here. I mean, they have been here in a small logistical capacity, but we're still not hearing anything about whether or not they will be landing on the ground and taking an active role in the peacekeeping. But Liberians here very much do want the United States to take a larger role.
We're talking to Nicole Itano. She is covering events in Liberia for the Christian Science Monitor. She is speaking to us from Monrovia. What about the whole issue of the war crimes tribunal for Charles Taylor?
Well, it seems, at least for the time being, that Charles Taylor is off the hook. The charges against him still stand. He's still indicted in for war crimes in the court in Sierra Leone. But it looks like, at least for the time being, that he has been given exile in Nigeria and that the Nigerians will protect him from being extradited to that court. There's mixed feelings here and in the region about that. I think there are some people here who feel very much that it is incredibly important that Charles Taylor does stand trial for those crimes, that he has been an incredibly destabilizing force in the region, and that in the long run, for Liberia's peace can really only be cemented by getting Charles Taylor permanently out of the picture, by making him face these war crimes. There is the fear that he could try to come back at some point from his exile in Nigeria.
And where is he exactly in Nigeria?
Well, we're told right now that he is in Abuja, the capital. He landed there yesterday in a plane with the Ghanaian president and the president of Mozambique. And we're told that he will be going to southeast Nigeria from there. But my understanding is at this moment he is still in Abuja, the capital.
Nicole Atano, covering events in Liberia for the Christian Science Monitor in Monrovia. And you are listening to Democracy Now! As we turn now to a local issue. And that issue is the issue of the Environmental Protection Agency. Right now, President Bush has put forward his nominee to be the new administrator of the EPA. In the days and weeks following the collapse of the World Trade Center, the White House pressured the Environmental Protection Agency not to warn New York residents about the potential health effects and not to issue guidelines for the public about cleaning apartments and offices. That's the conclusion of a yet-to-be-released investigation by the EPA's Inspector General, according to a report in the New York Times. The report goes on to say the White House's handling of the situation was influenced strongly by its desire to seek the stock markets quickly reopening on Wall Street. Before we go to that EPA report, we're joined on the line by Lawson Legate. He is Southwest Regional Director for the Sierra Club. He lives in Salt Lake City, Utah, where he speaks to us from. Can you talk about the announcement yesterday of President Bush to nominate the governor of Utah, Leavitt, to be the new administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency?
Yes. Governor Leavitt should be a pretty good fit for the Bush administration because Governor Leavitt is really a public figure. As a governor dealing with environmental issues, somebody who is prone to cut deals at the expense of the environment. And as we know from the Bush administration, their record on environmental issues is about as bad as a presidential administration's could be.
Can you talk specifically about Governor Leavitt's record?
Yes. As you may know, one of the great unfinished agendas in the western United States is that of protecting our remaining wildlands under our federal wilderness preservation system. And recently, Governor Leavitt, who is a great proponent of collaboration and openness, concluded a secret deal with the Secretary of the Interior to bring to a screeching halt the studies of remaining wildlands out in Utah and, by extension, the entire western United States to stop the wilderness studies that had been ongoing under the Department of Interior's Bureau of Land Management. Another example, Governor Leavitt has very doggedly persisted in promoting a damaging freeway, a freeway that would be destined to go through the Great Salt Lake Wetlands, which is an internationally recognized shorebird reserve. This would be a freeway that really is not needed. The answer, you know, in these modern times is more mass transit. And, in fact, we have some beginnings of that here, even in Utah, that have proven to be very, very popular, and it's a system that needs to be expanded. But the governor has been, we've challenged him in court successfully so far. We've had to go to court to prevent the construction of this freeway. I mean, we would be looking at more. We're one of the, actually, surprisingly, one of the most urban states in the nation because most of our population in Utah lives along a narrow corridor that we call the Wasatch Front. And we're sprawling, and we don't have a lot of farmland. And the freeway that the governor has been promoting would gobble up some of the best remaining farmland that we have in Utah. It's a bad idea, but the governor has been very stubborn about proceeding, and he continues to take another run at getting this very damaging freeway built.
Lawson Legate, Southwest Regional Director for Sierra Club. When we come back, we're going to talk about what happened under the previous administrator of the EPA, Christine Todd Whitman, and the report that the White House pressured the EPA not to warn the public after the collapse of the World Trade Center about the damaging health effects and what was in the environment after September 11th. Stay with us.
Oh, the trouble with the truth is it's always the same old thing. So hard to forget, so impossible for me to change. And every time I try to fight it, I know I'll be left to blame. Oh, the trouble. And the trouble with the truth is it's just what I need to hear. Ringing so right deep down inside my ear. And it's everything I want. And it's everything I feel. Oh, the trouble.
The Trouble with the Truth here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we talk about this latest report from the Inspector General's office and the Environmental Protection Agency about allegations that the White House told the Environmental Protection Agency, pressured them not to warn the public about the potential health effects, not to issue guidelines for the public about cleaning apartments and offices after the September 11th attacks in New York. We're joined on the telephone by Walter Hang. Walter Hang is president of Toxic Targeting, an environmental database company that tracks more than 5,000 toxic sites in New York State. Also, Hugh Kaufman, senior engineer for the Environmental Protection Agency and a former chief investigator for the EPA Ombudsman. Hugh Kaufman, can you talk about the significance of this Inspector General report?
Well, I think the Inspector General told your local congressman, Congressman Nadler, many months ago that they would publish their report by May of this year. That report never came out. Apparently that report was leaked to the New York Times last week. I haven't seen the report, and very few people have. Basically, the report, again, documents what the ombudsman had documented over a year and a half ago, that the Environmental Protection Agency did not follow their usual procedures in a major emergency, such as when the World Trade Towers came down, and instead told the public that things were safe without even having the monitoring done to determine whether it's safe or not. The significance of that is that up until the World Trade Towers came down, the Environmental Protection Agency had procedures to follow to protect the public if a terrorist attack occurred, and those procedures weren't followed, and tens of thousands of people were put at and are at health risk because EPA did not follow its usual procedures. The first responders, of course, received the major acute problems, and of course we're seeing now that over half of those first responders are sick, and the concern is that a large number of them will die very early because of cancer and other health effects because EPA did not do its job properly.
Walter Hang, can you respond?
Well, I just think that this is an unprecedented breach of public trust. When I first saw the images of the impact in the World Trade Center, and when I saw the towers coming down, I knew that that dust that was flying out of the towers was asbestos contaminated, because I knew that in 1971, Mount Sinai School of Medicine had done a study that showed that the asbestos was used to insulate the superstructure of the building. Afterwards, when I saw the fire at World Trade Center number 7, I knew that underneath the building was a giant substation that controlled the delivery of electricity to all of southern Manhattan. And I knew that there were huge transformers that were insulated with this oil that potentially could contain polychlorinated biphenyls, or PCBs. And perhaps most importantly, I knew that there was a high-voltage line from that giant substation to another substation in Brooklyn. And I knew that if the building collapsed, then the line would be severed and perhaps tens of thousands of gallons of oil would flow into the hole and catch fire. And if those materials contain PCBs, then the burning of that oil would be perhaps an unprecedented catastrophe because of the production of very, very toxic dioxins and dibenzofurans, which are among the most toxic compounds known to science. And indeed, afterwards, PCBs were detected in air, in dust samples all around the site, and perhaps for the first time ever, dioxin was detected in ambient air. So I just think that the EPA should have alerted the public to these problems. They should have protected the workers at the site. And I tried to alert the authorities to this problem that fall when the fires were still burning. And, you know, I just think that this is a very, very important issue that needs additional investigation.
The New York Times, which first reported on the Inspector General's report that has not yet been released, quotes the Environmental Protection Agency. We attempted to get the EPA on, but they said they would not come on. The report has irritated agency officials, says the Times, including Marianne Lamont-Horenko, the acting administrator, who said the inspector general's office did not understand how serious a crisis the attack on the Trade Center presented. She said it's almost like an academic look at an average emergency, and 911 wasn't academic or average. The agency has been criticized before for the statements it made about the quality of the attack. Your response to that, Hugh Kaufman?
Well, first of all, you got to understand that when the World Trade Towers came down, it was much the same as if a chemical plant blew up. Things that periodically happen, especially around the Houston area. And as a result of that, for over 20 years, the agency has procedures for taking samples and communicating to the public, evacuating the public, etc. I think the difference between the World Trade Center catastrophe and when a chemical plant goes up is that there's a higher density of population in the New York area than, say, around the Houston Ship Channel. In the mid-1990s, then-President Clinton created a presidential directive that set the procedures based on our 20 years' experience for responding to something like that. Major problems aren't just asbestos and PCBs when the trade towers came down. You also had a tremendous amount of lead. Every computer has 7 pounds of lead, and I think you know how many computers were in that building. Also, the smoke detectors have radioactive americium, and there are tens of thousands of those smoke detectors that were in that building. Plus the ultra-fine particulates. We had testimony in our two 11-hour hearings that Congressman Nadler asked us to hold, where we had the experts who had investigated the Kuwaiti oil field fires and found that a month after the World Trade Towers came down, the ultrafine particulates a mile north of the site, those levels were higher than when the Kuwaiti oil field fires were burning. So I think there was tremendous documentation, ultimately, about the magnitude of the problem and the impacts to working spaces and living spaces in New York. And the agency did not follow its usual procedures for cleanup and communication with the public that they had followed in other catastrophes when chemical plants, for example, or refineries would blow up. And I think That was the concern. Now, the Inspector General's draft report, apparently, according to the Times, claims that that was done as a result of White House pressure. But I'm not even sure that report will ever see the light of day, since it was promised by the Inspector General to Congressman Nadler to be published last May.
You are listening to Democracy Now! Hugh Kaufman is senior engineer for the Environmental Protection Agency and former chief investigator for the EPA Ombudsman. You were certainly issuing warning calls at that time. Can you talk about what you understood, Hugh Kaufman, in the EPA at the time of the September 11th attacks?
One of the concerns when we start to investigate, which is a couple of months after the attack, that we had was that EPA was providing false information to the public to just use wet rags and mops to clean their apartments, and that was certainly not going to do the job. The heating, ventilating, and air conditioning systems in the buildings needed to be thoroughly cleaned by trained hazardous material cleaners, and government procedures had to be followed. On top of that, the working crews at the site were not wearing a proper protective gear, and in fact, congressmen, senators, even the president of the United States were not wearing respirators, which they should have been wearing when they were around Ground Zero. Instead, they were wearing these paper masks, just like some of the first responders. And because of the ultrafine particulates, the paper masks would actually bring more contamination deeper into the lungs than if they didn't even have paper masks. So we started sending warnings to the first responders and to the public about the magnitude of the problem and what needed to be done. And of course, the political management, Christy Todd Whitman and her folks, were claiming that everything was safe. And now, apparently, the Inspector General's report has also documented that those statements were false.
What about Walter Hang, putting this in the context of the time, and then now the EPA administrator saying you have to look beyond this just being an emergency, that you have to look at the context and that the government wanted to be reassuring?
I don't, you know, disagree with the need to reassure the public, you know, in the immediate aftermath of a tragedy like the World Trade Center. But the problem is that the EPA had an enormous amount of data, you know, showing that more than perhaps 200,000 gallons of highly toxic and flammable materials were on fire, that pollution was just pouring out of the hole in one of the most densely developed areas of the country. And that problem is still ongoing. These contaminants, the lead, the dibenzofurans, the other toxic chemicals that released, accumulated, and they are not breaking down. The lead will be there for decades, hundreds of years. It's basically a permanent pollution problem, and the site has never been added to either the state superfund, the federal superfund, and the dioxin levels that were identified would have required an evacuation. Entire communities, such as Times Beach, Missouri, have been wiped off the map because of dioxin contamination, and this problem simply hasn't been addressed. They found PCBs in dust in buildings at 32 times the amount that constitutes hazardous waste. So every day, people are down in that area, walking around, exposed to the dust, potentially getting it in their systems, and over the course of time, that can increase their health problems. So emergency response is one thing, but ongoing failure to deal with this problem is another, and we just can't get the authorities to face this issue full force and solve it.
Well, the government is not only not telling people those things, but using financial incentives to get people to move into that whole area, giving something like, I believe, $6,000 a year rent subsidies, and a lot of people are coming from out of state to live in these areas to fill up the buildings in the area around the World Trade Center.
I think the situation is that they're so desperate to get the city back on its economic you know, footing, that they're overlooking the long-term health implications. I mean, people were returning to some of the homes and offices in the area, and you could literally see their footprints on the carpet where the asbestos, where the dust, the contaminated materials had accumulated on the floor. And in many cases, those areas have not been fully cleaned out. They haven't removed the carpeting. They haven't removed the ceiling tiles. They haven't cleaned out the ventilation systems. These contaminants are present in such tiny, tiny amounts that they're all but invisible to the naked eye. But people breathing these materials over the course of years can suffer long-term health problems. So I think we need an open discussion about these risks. I think these sites need to be more fully investigated and cleaned up. And that way, I'm sure that we can resolve this, but it's going to be an incredible long-term fight.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Walter Hang, president of Toxic Targeting, an environmental database company that tracks more than 5,000 individual toxic sites in New York, and Hugh Kaufman, senior engineer for the Environmental Protection Agency and former chief investigator for the EPA Ombudsman. Last question to Walter Hang, and that is, what can people do to protect themselves right now? What do you think is the single most important thing for those who live in and around the area? And how far out, for example, Christine Todd Whitman's own New Jersey, are people affected?
Well, they can go to www.toxicstargeting.com, and they can look at the letter and the data set that I provided to the authorities in November of 2001, and they can see exactly the kinds of compounds that were released. And then I think the key thing is to respond to the U.S. EPA and essentially say, put out the information, let us look at the data, and then if you live in that area and you're concerned about your health, then get the EPA in, use the appropriate technology to find out whether or not your space is contaminated. If you have children, if you have your own health risks that you're concerned about, get the EPA to respond directly. Right after the tragedy, the U.S. EPA was actually continuously monitoring the air from their offices just, you know, 5 or 10 blocks north of the World Trade Center. So there's a lot of information, and the EPA certainly has the capacity to do additional studies. And once that information is available, then people can make their decisions based on data for their apartment, their office, and drive the remediation process much more rapidly forward.
Walter Hang, Toxic Targeting, Hugh Kaufman, former chief investigator for the EPA Ombudsman, thanks for being with us. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to look at two cases. We're going to St. Louis, where a man's family is taking him to be deported, and we'll speak with the family as well as the Egyptian man. Then we will be joined by a man whose family was attacked this past weekend, a family of six in Queens, New York. Stay with us.
أمل حياتي يا حبي غالي ما ينتهيش يا أحلى غنوة غنوة
listening to Democracy Now!, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
In June of 2002, the Justice Department secretly deported 131 Pakistanis who had been held at INS detention centers around the country. None of the detainees had been charged with terrorism-related crimes. This was to be one in a series of mass deportations of Muslim men from different countries who were herded like cattle secretly in the dead of night and deported back, supposedly, to their respective countries. Their family and friends were not notified, and the deportations were often bungled. The deportees have been known to be dropped off in countries nowhere close to their native land, and disappearances under the guise of deportations is not uncommon.
An exclusive clip from the documentary Lest We Forget, which looks at post-911 immigration and deportation in the United States. It's by 25-year-old New York filmmaker Jason DeSilva. Narration is provided by Suher Hamad. As we turn now to the case of an Egyptian man who has been in the United States for the last 9 years. He's scheduled to be deported right now. Waleed Ghunam is married to an American woman and has 3 children. Although he's not been officially told, he'll presumably be deported to Egypt. His crime? He did not appear for his last appeal hearing on June 26th, even though the letter asking him to do so reached him 3 days after June 26th. We go to him now in St. Louis, Missouri. Welcome to Democracy Now! Waleed Ghunam, are you on the line?
Yes, ma'am, I'm on the line.
Can you tell me where you are, where your family is right now?
Well, now we are in the car, just heading up to the INS office.
You're headed to the INS office in St. Louis?
Yeah.
To be deported today?
Yes, ma'am.
And you've been here for 9 years. You're married to an American. Your children are Egyptian-American. On what grounds are they doing this?
Well, I've been accused of something I haven't been done, ma'am. And matter of fact, I was a victim of a scam in 95. And the INS in New York, when I went over there and they clear everything to me, everything is being eliminated or actually being just terminated, and I don't have anything on me. And during the rest of the time, I got legal with me, you know, asking me to fix my status. In the meantime, I was dating my wife, and after that, when we found out it could be dangerous for me, you know, to be leaving the country. We got married in 96, and we're still married right now, and the result of the marriage is 3 USA citizen kids, a son 6 years old, and 2 daughters 3 years old and 1.5 years.
When did they start going after you most recently? When did you realize you were on the path to deportation?
Pretty much in 2002.
After 911?
Yes, ma'am. At January 30 of 2002, they came to my job and arrested me from over there, from everybody in handcuffs, threw me in jail with the real, actually, you know, criminal people. It's not like, you know, with my case, like an INS case people. No, I was like with the real murder people, 2 drug dealers. Has the whole day. The second day, it was a hard time for my wife just to get in touch with me and try to get the bond money to get me out. After that, since that time, when I was leaving, even over there, after my wife paid the bond, refusing to give me my driver license and my social security, I don't deserve them because I'm illegal. And I asked for my driver license at least to take my son back and home for school. The same answer came from him. That's not his problem. And I have to go.
What about special registration? When people from various countries have to go to the newly named INS and register, many people being arrested when they do that.
Well, I went over there and I thought everything would be like easy. Like I was waiting outside in the waiting room outside and everybody was called his name. It won't take more than 5-7 minutes maximum. They get inside. They give you a couple piece sheets of paper, you read them, you understand them, and after that you take a picture, a print, and that's it. And they tell you, if you be more than 1 year, you have to come and renew it over here at any place. They give you, including the sheets. With me, they take so long at first before they're going to come and call my name, but after that, they call my name, and I had my lawyer with me. They refuse my lawyer to come and join me inside and see what's going on. And when I got inside, I found a two agent waiting for me, tell me I'm under arrest because there's a warrant for me. I didn't understand that time why the warrant for. My lawyer started to, he tried to get involved. They called the security, is calling me out of the building. And the only things I felt like they're doing some purpose with me because actually they was joking about escorting my lawyer outside the building and how they did it. Picked me with the handcuffs outside the building, going fire to the inside again.
Let me ask you before we lose you as you're driving, on the issue of this letter that arrived that said that you had to be at a hearing on June 26th that came 3 days later, how do they hold you responsible for that, 3 days after the hearing?
The letter came 3 days after the hearing. That was the result already. I failed to appear before the judge. And my lawyers, for me to call them over there, there is no way I can get contact with nobody and nobody can answer me and my questions. My lawyer tried to get with them. And finally, when he got contact with somebody, they told him we sent it regular mail. And he don't understand why they're going to send that particular letter on regular mail and the rest of the letter always come with certified mail. And it's like pretty much it's your word against my word. They send it and I don't receive it. And I don't know why, there is nothing in my side, for me do me any good to me to avoid that hearing. Because actually I'm the one who's waiting for this hearing.
Arti Shahani is with us in the studio with Families for Freedom, based in New York, involved with deportation and immigration work. How typical is Waleed Khunum's case? Is there any chance at a late date like this that the deportation could be turned around?
A few things. It's extraordinary how typical his situation is. You're looking at a man who entered the United States years and years ago, who did his best to get his papers in order. He hired an attorney, poured thousands of dollars into that. Meanwhile, having that sort of bureaucracy going on, that sort of disastrous waiting through the INS system going on, he fell in love with an American woman, got married and had 3 children with her. And now, because he got screwed over by a lawyer who took his money, was not accountable to him, did not follow up with him as he had promised, because of that, and because of a government bureaucracy that is unforgiving, that doesn't know where it puts its papers and doesn't know how to postmark things in advance, because of all that, a family is being torn apart. That is extremely common. I've seen in the last 3 years of doing anti-detention work, hundreds and hundreds of families from all walks of life being torn apart. Especially since September 11th, you sort of see this intensification of enforcement. You see that the government is even more unforgiving. It becomes even more impossible to, for example, go to your congressional office and ask for help in a situation like this, because no one wants to touch this stuff. It's amazing the number of families I've taken to congressional offices and said, listen, these people are right now in deportation because of X, Y, and Z factors. We're asking you to lend support to your constituents, to your community members, to contact the INS and ask for an extra few weeks here or an extra month here to process such and such paper. And they don't want to step in because they're afraid there's a war on terrorism going on. I just can't interfere. We have to be careful because of the national security. And now you listen to this man who's driving to immigration, to the airport, to get deported. And you have to think to yourself, he's got his kids in his car. He's got a wife in his car. And what does that have to do with national security?
Anna Ghunam is in the car with her husband, Waleed Ghunam. And, Waleed, I was wondering if you can put her on the line right now.
Okay, hold on.
Thank you. She and her Hello. Children are not being told where Waleed Ghunam will be sent. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Anna Ghunam. Can you talk about what will you do after Waleed Ghunam is deported?
I really don't know right now. I'm going to have to try to look for employment, and it's hard. You have 3 kids, 3 young children, and my parents cannot, they're still working, so.
How old are your children?
1, 3, and 6. I just...
Have you asked where your husband will be deported?
I'm sorry?
Have you asked where your husband will be deported?
Well, where will he be deported to?
Yes.
Egypt. Back to Egypt.
And then what happens? Can you visit him? Can you reapply for him to enter the United States again?
Well, his case is still under appeal. They're making him leave, and his case is still under appeal. They said I will just have to deal with the rest of it. Me, our attorney, and myself, we will have to speak in his behalf.
How often, let me ask?
They said it could be up to a year and a half before we get an answer, whether yes or no, that he can't even have another court date.
Artie Shahani, how often is someone deported before the appeal?
Constantly.
So, constantly.
What happens is that there are two different court systems going on. There's the immigration court system and the federal court system. Likely this couple appealed their case in a federal court system to reopen the case. While you have an appeal pending in a federal court system, and sometimes even at the appeals level of an immigration court, there is no automatic stay on the deportation order itself. So that what that means is that you could have a situation, and this happens all the time, where you have a very valid, strong legal claim to reopening your case. It could be something as simple as, my lawyer's been disbarred, he ineffectively assisted me, I need to reopen my case, I have proof that I was ineffectively assisted. It could be things like that. But you have to, it's sort of like a crapshoot. You might get deported before that case ever gets heard. And that happens all the time, because structurally the system is made to not prevent things like that.
Well, we will continue to follow this case of Waleed and Anna Ghunam as they head now in the car for Waleed Ghunam to be deported to Egypt. We turn now to another story. Surinder Singh, his wife, two kids, and a cousin are a family in Queens who this past Sunday were attacked and beaten up by three white men in Queens. The family's been in the United States for 17 years. Surinder Singh joins us in the studio now. He is a cab driver here in the city. What happened Sunday?
We came from to visit Long Island, and then we buy the dinner to come home eat. And soon we get out of the car and see my turban. They start cursing me. And then they get out and they push me. And then start aggravation, a little fight. And I call my wife and cousin. They not even get home. And they attack on a cousin and they knock him on the floor. And then we all started their big scene. And my wife tried to broke the fight, everything. But then we can't do anything better than the pizza guy come and a neighborhood two ladies come. They help us.
A pizza man, a delivery
yeah,
man,
delivery
came to help.
Pizza man, yeah.
You and your cousin were both wear turbans.
No, he not wear the turban.
Just
I
you.
Wear the turban,
uh-huh.
Yes.
Did they say anything, the man?
Yeah, they say, Bin Laden, go back to your country.
Did you recognize them?
A little bit, you know, it's a shortly time. It's like a 4 or 5 minutes happens, and it's hard to, you know, because we don't want to be anything problem. We try to ignore, you know.
Right. But did you recognize the men? Did you know who they were?
Oh, yes.
You knew the men who attacked you?
No. We don't know who they are. They're strange.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
How have the police dealt with this?
They're very good now. The police is very good with us. They help good.
We're also joined on the line by Ravinder Singh Bala, who is an attorney for Amerik Singh Rathore, who was a New York police officer who was fired on June 18th last year for refusing to take off his turban and shave his beard. Ravinder Singh Bala filed a federal discrimination complaint with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission on behalf of his client. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you for having me.
Can you talk about what happened with Amerik Singh Rathore?
Sure. And first, I'd just like to thank you for having me on the show and for highlighting these issues. It's much appreciated. What happened with Amerik is fairly simple. He went through the standard process of applying for a position as an officer with the NYPD. He took several exams, a psychological test, a physical test, a written exam, and also a background check, all pursuant to this application process. And he passed everything. He was fully qualified to be a police officer, and he was in fact sworn in, not as a police officer, as a traffic enforcement agent. It's a different type of officer, the NYPD. And he was actually sworn in as an officer and began the training period. At that point, he was told that he would not be permitted to serve as an officer with his turban on because, according to the NYPD, that conflicted with the hat requirement for NYPD officers. He was essentially put in a position where he was given a choice. Choose between practicing your religion and your job, and it's a terrible choice for anyone to have to make between their livelihood and their religion. That's the place he was put in, and he did not want to sacrifice his religious practice, and he was thereafter fired.
You know, I'm wondering, Surinder Singh, if you can explain the religious significance of the turban and what does it mean for a man to take off that turban?
I mean, like, why we wear the turban?
Yes.
Yes, this is like, the army soldier, they have to wear the hat and you recognize to this is the army. This is a Sikh religion symbol. To anybody wear the turban, you have to be, without ask anybody, have to be know this is Sikh. And mostly in the world, 99% Sikh wear the turban, nobody else. It's very simple.
Yeah, Amy, it's a fundamental symbol of the Sikh religious faith. It represents, in part, the Sikh belief in serving society, to serve and protect, actually, society. And it's a part of our uniform as members of the faith.
Finally, Artie Shahani, how common is what we are hearing right now? We just have a few seconds before we play the last clip of the film.
I brought with me the New York Times page that had an article about him and the racial attacks. And what's interesting is on his article it says three Indians attacked on the street and the police call it bias. On the exact same page, there's an article about a widow whose African husband was shot dead by police, and then another article about a Latina woman who was shot dead by police. And so what I think is interesting in so much of what we're hearing now is that these attacks on people because they are people of color, because they are immigrants, is happening all the time. But who it's perpetrated by is both people within the community and the police department.
And those who can be targets, who could serve in the police department, have been fired.
Exactly.
Well, I want to thank you all for being with us. Surinder Singh and Ravinder Singh Bala, the attorney for Amarik Singh Rathore, as we wrap up with the clip of Lest We Forget of Jason Da Silva.
In March 2003, with the beginning of America's war on Iraq, a new wave of bias crimes occurred. In Indianapolis, an Afghan American was severely injured after two people burst into his restaurant and set him on fire. Projectiles were fired at a mosque in Chicago. Graffiti in San Jose University warned that Muslims would be shot. And in New Jersey, a Pakistani man was beaten unconscious by two white men screaming profanities about Islam. The question arises, who becomes America's enemy next? Lest you forget, I will repeat myself. Your ignoring me does not make me go away. I am part of you, a limb, your roots, and I will repeat myself to get attention, to be acknowledged. I am a shame, and your silence will not disappear me. I will repeat myself until you deal with me.
You are listening to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Thanks for being with us.